Hey everybody, it's the Sound Off 121 here on SCScoops.com for Monday, August 16th, 2010. I am the Solid Monster here with you, a special post-SummerSlam pay-per-view edition of the Sound Off here on SCScoops.com. I wanted to wait until after the pay-per-view. Wasn't going to get home in time to record a show before SummerSlam yesterday, so I figured, you know what, why not do one with some post-SummerSlam thoughts here, and we'll break into all the other news of the week. It was a very busy week in terms of wrestling news, especially over the last couple of days. So we're going to get to a whole ton of shit here on the podcast this week. But, of course, we will start with the 23rd annual WWE SummerSlam pay-per-view. Last night, Staples Center, Los Angeles. Of course, this is the second year in a row that SummerSlam is emanating from L.A. And that is likely going to be the plan for some time to come. WWE loves to hobnob with people in Hollywood, and they figure it's good to get to L.A. for a week and do some business while preparing for one of the bigger pay-per-views of the year. Traditionally, the third biggest behind the Royal Rumble and WrestleMania. And this year's SummerSlam was no exception. In fact, this year's SummerSlam had something that the event has not had in recent years, and that was a very strong storyline going into the show, circling around, of course, the Nexus. And really, this was a one-match show, if you think about it. On paper, it was really built around the whole Team WWE against Nexus concept. And so the question is, did that match deliver? Did SummerSlam deliver? I will call SummerSlam a good show. And that's about as far as I can take it. I cannot call SummerSlam a very good show. I cannot call it an excellent show, because that would be a blatant lie. I did order the pay-per-view last night. I was on the fence whether or not I was actually going to order the show, and I decided to invest my $44.95 in SummerSlam. And did I come away from it disappointed? Disappointed, yes. It was a good show. Was it worth $44.95? Absolutely not. But then again, very few pay-per-views are. I just think the prices are ridiculous. But a good SummerSlam, and that may be pushing it a little bit. It was a one-match show. We'll get to the main event in just a little bit. I think it probably makes sense to just go through the whole card, since I watched it from start to finish, and just give my thoughts here. Pay-per-view started off with an Intercontinental Championship match. Dolph Ziggler defending against the former champion Kofi Kingston. There were rumors going into the pay-per-view within the last couple of days that this match was actually going to be switched to a six-pack challenge that would have involved the likes of Drew McIntyre and Cody Rhodes and Matt Hardy. And it's almost a shame that it didn't. Now, in fairness, this match, in looking back on the pay-per-view, this match was probably, if on paper, it wasn't really much, but it turned out to be one of the better matches of the entire show. I probably would have to give the edge to the main event, but this was a pretty good match up until the finish. The crowd started getting into it more towards the end. There was some good wrestling. Dolph was, you know, bumping around like a madman. And hooks on his sleeper hold at the end of the match. And so out come Nexus to interfere. They beat both guys down. They toss Ziggler out of the ring. He gets clotheslined out. Kofi gets up. He's surrounded by Nexus. Valiantly tries to fight them off. He gets beaten down. Why nobody came out to save Kofi, I don't know. The crowd seemed to be into the whole Nexus interference, and it kind of made them stronger, I guess, going into the main event, although there really wasn't any where you could go. I mean, Nexus was made to look as strong as they're going to look going into the pay-per-view. This would have been nice to have had an actual finish to this match. Obviously, this just means that this feud is going to continue. So not a big fan of the non-finish here, but whatever. Nexus comes out. They cut a pretty basic promo about how this is how John Cena is going to be at the end of the night, you know, flat on his back and all this other stuff. We get a segment, Chris Jericho and The Miz interacting backstage. It was more so Jericho and Edge trying to convince The Miz to join Team WWE because their very livelihoods are on the line. I'm still not quite sure what the sense of urgency was. You know, why are there jobs? Why is the entire WWE universe, why should they be so worried if Nexus wins this match? That was never really established, but Miz basically blew them off and said, look, you'll get your answer later. Maybe I'll join, maybe I won't. This was played up for comedy, with Edge throughout the entire segment snapping into a Slim Jim. So there you go. Alicia Fox and Melina for the Divas Championship. I posted a column a few days before the pay-per-view with my SummerSlam predictions, the official 2010 SE Scoop SummerSlam predictions, and I predicted that Alicia Fox would retain the title here. Why? Well, Melina just came back from an injury. She was gone for many, many months, and got a victory over Alicia on Raw last week. And so I figured, well, Alicia already lost, and they don't really have too many other viable challengers for the Divas title, and Melina just came back, so why not give Alicia a win at the pay-per-view, maybe build to a rematch at the Night of Champions, or perhaps something like that. So, of course, they go ahead and they have Melina win the Women's Championship from Alicia Fox. Okay, the match was not really that good, but what do you expect? Lay Cool, Michelle McCool, and Layla come out. Layla's pretty cool. Michelle gets on my nerves. I do get a kick out of the split belt gimmick, since they basically broke the women's belt in half, and each carries their half of the belt. They came out generally being very obnoxious, and Melina shoved both of them down. I think Alicia tried to make a save at one point. She got thrown out of the ring, and basically Lay Cool was just being annoying, and then they just beat the crap out of Melina. I have no idea where they're going with this. If they're building to some sort of a title unification, they'll have to unify the women's belt literally back into one piece before they can unify both belts. But, like I said, I don't really see that many challengers on the Raw brand for the Divas Championship. So unless they're going to keep this thing going with Melina and Alicia, what the whole point of Lay Cool coming out and beating up Melina was, unless they're building to some sort of an inter-brand match at the next pay-per-view, I'm not quite sure, but I guess we'll find out. This was nothing much. Big Show against all three members of the Straight Edge Society. Another bad pick by me. I figured the Straight Edge Society would probably be made to look bad, to look like fools in this match, but they would win. And, of course, that did not happen. They did look pretty foolish, and they lost. CM Punk basically walked out on his partners. Joey Mercury got chokeslammed. And I believe Luke Gallows was chokeslammed on top of Joey Mercury, or maybe it was vice versa. In any event, Big Show got the pin. I suppose they're building to a singles match between Punk and Big Show. Punk was great in this match. His facials, just everything he does, everything about CM Punk is fantastic. Big Show, you know, babyface Big Show is what he is. Nothing special about this match at all. Kind of a waste, actually. Kane backstage in a segment with the casket with this really dramatic, just completely hokey, cheesy music playing in the background. Sheamus comes up to him, so for those of you thinking, oh, we're going to get a Sheamus-Kane match, we're not. They've done this before. You may remember, actually, I want to say it was Survivor Series back in 2003. I believe Brock Lesnar was the WWE champion and Goldberg was the World Heavyweight Champion. I remember there being some sort of stare-down between them at a pay-per-view, maybe it was a Rumble. That did build to a WrestleMania match between the two of them, but we've gotten plenty of segments like this where it really just builds to nothing. You know, it's just a tease. They wanted both champions in the same segment. I did crack up. Kane made a comment at one point. You know, Sheamus was obviously standing up to him and talking back to him, and Kane started laughing. And he basically said, you know what? I like you. You've got a lot of guts. And then all of a sudden, Kane kind of turned mean, and he said, you know, which only means that I'm going to spill your guts all over the place if you ever interrupt me again. I just thought the way that he said that was kind of funny. Nothing much, really, to this segment. And then we got yet another promo. The Miz comes out before the live crowd to cut a pretty lengthy promo. It was pretty damn good, I have to say. No surprise there. Miz is obviously awesome on the microphone. You don't need me to tell you that. And basically the whole point of it was Miz was going to give his answer as to whether or not he would accept the invitation to join Team WWE. And he did. He said he would be there. He would be the savior of the WWE. And the crowd really didn't react much when he made that announcement finally, which was kind of surprising. They didn't really boo or cheer too much. They were kind of indifferent towards the whole thing, but still a great promo by Miz. Michael Cole, of course, was just going absolutely bonkers about this. And this would be a pattern throughout the night, especially during the main event. Michael Cole is the biggest Miz mark on commentary that you'll ever see. And, I mean, you would think he was the guy's manager, for crying out loud. Sheamus, Randy Orton, WWE Championship on the line. I was looking forward to this match after the build from Raw last Monday. I thought that segment between Orton and Sheamus was actually really, really good. Last Monday night. It was essentially just two guys judge-acking back and forth about how they think they're the better man, and the title means so much to them that they are going to be walking away with the WWE Championship. Excuse me. Pretty simple stuff. You don't have to overcomplicate it. And unfortunately, the match did not deliver on the hype. Now, Orton and Sheamus had their very first singles encounter on pay-per-view earlier this year at the Royal Rumble. And I don't remember that match being particularly that great. There was kind of a fucked finish at the end where Legacy ran in. There really was no clear-cut winner, but at least it played into a storyline. It played into the whole Orton Legacy implosion back at the Royal Rumble. There was no reason to have a fucked finish in this match, especially your WWE Championship match, even though it's not in the main event slot. They went with a lame DQ finish. Now, this would be the second time on the show that a title match had no legit finish. I mean, obviously, Nexus ran in the opening contest. There just was no winner. This was a little bit different, but basically what happened is the match was pretty goddamn boring, to be perfectly honest with you, until the last 5 minutes or so. Things really did pick up at the end. The crowd started getting into it. Orton started, you know, hulking up, for lack of a better term. And basically, Sheamus went outside, grabbed a chair, came in the ring, and referee Jack Doan would have none of this. He tried to pull the chair away from Sheamus. Sheamus kept fighting him until finally Jack Doan got tossed through the ropes violently to the outside. I just cracked up like crazy when he fell out of the ring, and before he could even sell the impact of his fall, Jack Doan starts flailing his arms around violently to call for the bell. I just thought that was funny. Sheamus smirks because he realizes he's been disqualified, but he retains the title. Cheap way to do it, but he's a heel. So Sheamus retains the title on a disqualification. Orton did beat the hell out of him after the match and gave him an RKO on the announce table, which did not break. Now, here's my question. I don't quite understand what the point is in doing moves on top of the announce table. I mean, is the impact all that different? Wouldn't the impact be greater in the ring? I mean, I know the ring has a little more give to it, but still, I don't understand why people go through the hassle of going out of the ring. You've got to clear off the table, you've got to take the monitors out, because, you know, you really don't want to hurt the other person. Climb up onto the table, do your move. I just don't see... Just do your move in the ring. Do it on the floor. Why not do it on the floor? Why do you have to get up on the table and do it? I don't understand that. The other thing I didn't understand is why The Miz didn't come out at this point to cash in his money in the bank. Now, I did not want Miz, nor did I expect him to cash it in, but if you're thinking in terms of the WWE Universe, if you're The Miz, you've tried multiple times now over the last couple of weeks to cash in your briefcase on Raw. Now the champion has been literally killed dead. He's been knocked out unconscious for about 10 minutes. And you don't come out to cash in, especially in your city. You're in LA, you're in Hollywood. Why wouldn't you want to come out and cash in the briefcase? Doesn't make any sense. But anyway, Sheamus retains. I assume this feud is going to continue, but I could have done without the bullshit finish. This kind of reminded me of a title match that Orton had with John Cena at SummerSlam back, I want to say 2 or 3 years ago. It was either 07 or 08, where, if I recall correctly, there was also a bullshit disqualification finish. I think Orton punched the ref in the face or something like that in like 7 or 8 minutes. It was just completely lame and ridiculous. This wasn't quite as lame, but it was still lame nonetheless. Kane and Rey Mysterio, World Heavyweight Championship on the line. I did not expect this to be a good match, and it wasn't that good. It was okay. It was fine. The crowd did pick up a little bit towards the end. At least the one thing about this match I could appreciate was the fact that Kane won clean. He won with authority. He was giving Rey what I thought was a one-arm chokeslam. He did kind of put the other arm behind him to give himself some support, but it was a violent chokeslam. And he pinned Rey Mysterio 1-2-3 to end the match. Now, Kane brought a casket with him down to the ring. It was the worst-kept secret in wrestling that Undertaker would likely be making some sort of appearance, either on screen, on the video wall, or actually in person at this pay-per-view. It was just a matter of how. And would it be during the match? Would he cost Kane the match? Would it be post-match? So, as soon as I saw Kane wheeling the casket down to the ring, I knew exactly what was going to happen. And we've seen it a million times before. He would open the casket numerous times during the match to show people that there was nobody in there, even though we knew that Undertaker was going to be in there at some point. And the thing that really gave it away to me, and I don't know, I'm sure I'm not the only one who noticed this, but at different points when Kane would open the casket, and the camera would focus in the empty casket, I could have sworn that the bottom of that casket was moving around. So you can almost tell there was someone or something underneath that casket. So anyway, tried to put Ray in there, couldn't get him in there. He beats Ray, he gives Ray the tombstone pile driver. So finally, Ray is out. Ray is not going to fight back now. Kane goes back over to the casket, opens it, and sure as shit, there's the Undertaker laying in the casket. The crowd goes nuts. Undertaker raises up, and my God, does the Undertaker look old. He looks like he just aged 1,000 years in the few months that he's been off. So anyway, he comes out of the casket, and he does so very slowly. He looks drunk. The Undertaker looks like he's had one too many. And I assume this is playing into the storyline. You know, Undertaker's been in a vegetative state, so maybe he's weakened. At least I hope it is, because if it's not, Undertaker looked unbelievably dreadful tonight. He was moving around slowly. He was stumbling around. He was actually coughing. I'm kind of intrigued to see where they're going with this, but at least for this night, he looked fucking atrocious. He actually looked like he was bigger, too, and I don't mean jacked. I mean, he looked a little fatter, like he had gained some weight. And I suppose being a married man again will do that to you. Undertaker gets down in the corner. Rey Mysterio is basically laying in the corner. Undertaker crouches down, and I can hear everything Undertaker is saying, but I could not hear what Rey was saying, and I can only imagine it was worse for the people in the arena, who probably could not hear any of this. This went on a little too long. The crowd started to get out of it. You know, Undertaker was just kneeling down, talking to Rey, having a conversation for about 2 minutes before he finally said, "I believe you," basically implying that he believes Rey, that Rey didn't do it, and Kane probably did fuck him over. Undertaker goozles Rey by the throat, picks him up, and then he turns around and stares at Kane, and the crowd goes crazy. And Undertaker goes and grabs Kane by the throat, and then he proceeds to do absolutely nothing. I guess because he's too weak. So the Undertaker is too weak. Kane grabs him by the throat, and instead Kane gives Undertaker a tombstone and leaves his brother laying. So the implication here is that it was in fact Kane who did attack his brother back over the Memorial Day holiday. Perhaps the Undertaker used all the mustard during the family barbecue and pissed Kane off. I don't know. Perhaps we'll get an explanation on SmackDown this week. You know, perhaps Undertaker is lactose intolerant, and maybe Kane put some cheese on his hamburger, and I don't know what happened, but we'll find out. Undertaker did not look good, but like I said, I hope and assume this is playing into the storyline that he's been comatose for months now, and therefore he's still in a weakened state. I assume they're building to a title match between the two of them at the Night of Champions, where Undertaker will perhaps win his 7th or 8th or 9th championship. Unless they want to build this up until the Hell in a Cell pay-per-view and maybe put the two of them in a cage in October. I guess we'll find out. So that pretty much left the main event. And up until this point, this was not a good pay-per-view. Let's be honest here. This was not a good pay-per-view. WWE is capable of putting on better shows than this. But this was really a one-match show anyway going in. So it all builds to the main event. Team WWE, John Cena, Chris Jericho, Edge, R-Truth, John Morrison, and Bret the Hitman Hart, taking on the Nexus, David Otunga, Wade Barrett, Heath Slater, Michael Tarver, Justin Gabriel, Darren Young, and Skip Sheffield. It is a 7-on-6 Survivor Series-style elimination match. So basically, the big question was, who would be the 7th man? We found out earlier in the show that The Miz had accepted the invitation. So The Miz is introduced, and John Cena says, "Hold on a second. Miz is not, in fact, going to be on their team." Cena says they got tired of waiting. They couldn't wait for an answer from him, so they went and they found somebody else. And they found somebody who actually had just as much of an issue with Nexus as they did. And, of course, that turned out to be the American Dragon himself, Bryan Danielson. Or, as he is, I guess, going to still be called, Daniel Bryan. Really happy to see him back. For those people saying, "See, it was a work all along," that doesn't mean it was a work. I still feel he was let go. It was more of a, "We have to do this sort of thing, but we'll hire you back," and that's what happened. You know, the thing about it, though, that I just am amazed by is during the pay-per-view, I noticed a couple of different websites mentioning the fact that WWE.com had posted a major SummerSlam spoiler on their own website before the main event even started. So I did not want to know what this surprise was, so I avoided it. But after Daniel Bryan was introduced, I went back, and sure as shit, I guess what happened is Joey Styles and the great folks at WWE.com had prepared an item announcing that Bryan Danielson had in fact returned at SummerSlam, and they must have accidentally posted it before the pay-per-view was even over, thus spoiling the surprise for millions of people. Sucks to be them. It just goes to show you really can't be surfing around wrestling websites during a pay-per-view. I mean, if you do, you do so at your own peril. That's why I avoided it. So that kind of sucked. But I was elated to see Daniel Bryan back, just because it's an injustice that's been righted. I mean, if it was a storyline all along, fine. I don't think it was. And, you know, the guy deserves better than that. And he got a very good response coming out, which I'm sure would have shocked some people who figured, hey, if Daniel Bryan turns out to be the big surprise, he ain't going to get no reaction. Well, he did. He got a nice reaction, as a matter of fact. Not an overwhelming one, but he got a nice reaction. People knew who he was. And so began the match. And he was made to look strong right from the opening bell. Within the first minute, minute and a half of the match, in fact, he tapped out Darren Young to prove that he is, in fact, loyal to Team WWE. Now, Michael Cole, on commentary, throughout the entire match, did nothing but bash Daniel Bryan. So this storyline continues. And for the people who say, well, Michael Cole is unbearable, I can't believe he's talking shit about Daniel Bryan, let's separate you know, fantasy from reality here. First of all, we all accept the fact that Michael Cole just is not a very good wrestling announcer. He has his moments, but he's just not very good. But I'm not going to blame Michael Cole for bashing Daniel Bryan. That's what he's told to do. I assume this is playing into a bigger storyline here. Now, what that could be, I don't know. Unless they're going to take Cole off commentary and make him Miz's manager, because he basically filleted the Miz on commentary throughout the entire evening and did nothing but bash Bryan Danielson. So, you know, my guess is they're building to a United States Championship feud between the two of them. But, you know, if Michael Cole's job, if Michael Cole is being told to bash Daniel Bryan and praise the Miz, and there's nothing else to it, I don't see what the point is. You know, he is your play-by-play guy. He is the face of your promotion in terms of your announcers. And unless you're going to replace him with Jim Ross or somebody else and take him out of the booth at some point, you know, you're basically, it's almost like he's a heel announcer in a way. It's not his job to be opinionated. You know, I do a podcast, so I give my own opinions. That's what people do when they do a podcast. If you're a color announcer, your job is to give color. You can give your own opinions. If you're a play-by-play guy, you really should not be giving your own opinions. So I don't know why they're scripting him to do this unless it plays into a larger storyline. So assuming that is the case, I actually am kind of entertained by it. I'm not offended by it at all. Every time he would say something new about, he would call, you know, Bryan Danielson a fool, or I forgot the different words that he, the names that he was calling him, but I would just cackle every single time, because my hope is that when this storyline plays itself out, the end result will be Daniel Bryan beating the holy fuck out of Michael Cole, and if that's the payoff, I'm okay with that. But it did get kind of distracting throughout the night. We'll get to that in a second, where Miz came back in the match. But in any event, the way I'll do this is, let me outline the things I liked about this match. We'll do the pros and the cons. The match went about 35 minutes or so. So it had plenty of time. It did not feel rushed to me at any point. That's a good thing. I'm a fan of Survivor Series matches, even though I know it's kind of passé. They don't mean quite what they used to. And we haven't gotten very many of them in recent years. Usually it's like one or two per year at the pay-per-view. But I am a fan of those matches. And this was the biggest Survivor Series-style match that we've seen in many, many years. It was not the biggest of all time. If you recall the very first Survivor Series, in fact, maybe the first two Survivor Series pay-per-views in 87 and 88, they had much bigger matches. In fact, I vividly recall one particular match. It might have actually been the very first Survivor Series match at the very first pay-per-view that had a 20-man elimination match. It basically consisted, it was 10-on-10, and it was all tag teams. So when you literally speak about the size of these matches, this was not the biggest Survivor Series match of all time, but it was the biggest in many years, and I like that. I like seeing all those guys out there, elimination style. I like that format. So that's a good thing, and they gave it plenty of time. Daniel Bryan coming back was a good thing. He deserves it. He's awesome in the ring. He proved it tonight. He was made to look very, very strong. And I think that was really the key to this match. Daniel Bryan was made to look very, very strong. He came out. He got an elimination right away. He didn't really tag back in until the end of the match. But when he did, that 90 seconds or so of offense that he had before he made, I want to say it was Heath Slater tap out, but I can't remember. He looked phenomenal in there. When he tagged in, he got the hot tag towards the end of the match. He was going, he's so fluid in the ring. People were actually popping. They were going nuts for the guy. He hit all of his moves. They popped huge for the armbar submission, which just makes John Cena's STF look like a tap on the shoulder. You know, Daniel Bryan's submission hold actually looks painful if you watch it. Completely realistic, unlike the STF that John Cena uses. But that was the biggest plus to me of this match, how strongly Daniel Bryan was made to look. Even when he got eliminated, you know, Miz did come back out. He was pissed off. He was embarrassed earlier on. He hit Danielson from behind with the briefcase and knocked him out. He got pinned, I believe, by Skip Sheffield. Or maybe it wasn't Skip Sheffield, but he got pinned by Wade Barrett, I believe it was. And that's fine, because the guy got hit from behind with a briefcase. Doesn't make him look weak at all. And it basically rekindles the Miz-Danielson feud. My guess, if I just had a venture guess here, at the Night of Champions, the two of them will have a title match, and Daniel Bryan will win the U.S. belt. Because let's be honest here, he has the briefcase. Miz does not need the U.S. title anymore. He is beyond that. So that's how I would book this. But just a phenomenal job in terms of how Daniel Bryan was presented. That's about all the good things I can say. I mean, the match itself was actually quite good. Nexus held their own. Again, keep in mind, there are a bunch of rookies in there. And collectively, it was kind of a crapshoot what you were going to get. This match could have fallen apart very easily. I didn't expect it to because these guys have improved and they're in there with total pros. I mean, Edge, Jericho, you know, even Cena can carry the match. I didn't think it would fall apart or anything like that. But I thought Nexus did a fine job in there. There was never a point where they embarrassed themselves, where they fucked up a huge move or anything like that. So good job. Thumbs up on that. The match itself was actually pretty good. That's about where it ends. Obviously, I had predicted that John Morrison would turn heel. He did not. I was wrong. I do think he should still go heel at some point because I just think he's much better as a heel. But that did not happen. And, I mean, there were a couple of different points. Actually, I'm sorry. There is one more thing I really, really liked about this match. Bret Hart. There were a lot of people. I got messages on my Facebook, on my Twitter, on my email. Why is Bret Hart in this match? He can't move, he can't take bumps, he can't do anything. Well, that may well be true, but I said before I like the idea of Bret being in this match because it brings an element of star power. I mean, there was already a lot of star power packed into this match, but having Bret the Hitman Hart on Team WWE teaming up with John Cena and Chris Jericho and all those guys is kind of a cool thing. And I didn't expect him to do much. I knew he wouldn't take any bumps. And bigger question, and I even talked about this in the editorial I posted on SE Scoops with our official predictions a couple of days ago. There really were only two ways to get rid of Bret Hart, unless he was going to be one of the sole survivors in this match, which I did not expect. The only way to really eliminate him would have been by some sort of DQ or countout. And sure enough, they did go with the disqualification. Bret Hart tagged in, and it was great too, because before Bret got tagged in, the crowd at one point was loudly chanting, "We want Bret, we want Bret." Unfortunately, he wore those fucking jean shorts in this match, which just pissed me off. God, I hate when he wears that. But he tagged in, and not for nothing, I thought Bret Hart looked pretty damn good in there. When you compare his performance in this match to his performance in the ring at WrestleMania, it is like night and day. I mean, Bret Hart is not going to go in there and take the chest-first bump into the turnbuckles and be as fast and do all the fancy moves he used to do in the side Russian leg sweep because he can't risk bumping his head on the mat. He can't do all that. But having said that, he did more in this match in the 2 minutes or so he was in there than I thought he would. He didn't take any bumps. He got all the offense. It was him and Heath Slater. But his punches looked crisp. He climbed up in the corner and just was going. He was the house of fire. He was going nuts. He didn't look slow at all. beating the hell out of Heath Slater, came back down, gave him an inverted atomic drop, clotheslined him down, went for a sharpshooter. Place went bonkers. Now, at this point, I believe it was Skip Sheffield slid a chair into the ring, seemingly for Heath to use. Of course, Brett let go of the sharpshooter before he could really put it on, picked up the chair, hit Sheffield in the gut with it. Then he hit Slater, I believe, or whoever, whichever member of Nexus it was, in the back with the chair. Pretty hard chair shot to the back. Got disqualified, and that was it. That was the end for Bret Hart. The fans were not happy about this. I was unhappy just because I wanted to see Bret in there a little bit longer. But I understood why they did it. He was booked as good as he could possibly be booked in this match. And Bret took his leave, and that was the end of the Hitman. But for the time he was in there, I don't care what anybody says. If you didn't watch this pay-per-view, you can't speak because you didn't see it. But if you saw it, I don't see how you can look at what Bret Hart did last night and think, man, he looked terrible. He looked the way that you would expect him to look, but he looked better in the ring than I thought he would. You know, he wasn't as slow, he didn't fall over, he didn't fuck up any moves, and he did more than I thought he would do. So, thumbs up to Bret Hart. I thought he looked great, all things considered, last night. He looked a hell of a lot better than The Undertaker did, I know that. So, that's pretty much what I liked about that match. What I did not like about the match was the end of the match. Now, listen. I don't know where they're going to go with the Nexus storyline. My guess is this is not the end of it, even though they lost. Oh yes, Nexus lost. I don't believe for a second that the storyline is over. If it is, it's the biggest botch since the invasion of 10 years ago. So I just cannot believe that they would do that. So this will continue, but there was no reason to make Nexus look weak by having them lose. I just don't understand the logic behind it. Now, some people would say, well, Solid Monster, you know, they wanted to go off the air and give people something happy to go off the air. Fuck that! Fuck the people going home happy. Sometimes you can't send them home happy. I didn't go home happy. I was already home. I wasn't happy when that pay-per-view ended, I could tell you that. What about me? What about all the people who sent me all those messages last night? Bitching and moaning about the end of that pay-per-view, and some people went a little overboard with it. My logic is this. It's not even so much that they lost. I think what really infuriated me was the way that it happened. I think if it was booked differently, maybe I wouldn't have been as irked. I still would have thought it was a dumb thing for them to lose. Because there were a million different ways you could have gone, had them win, and it's not as though Cena is in any way weakened by this, whether somebody went heel. I mean, I'm actually happy that Daniel Bryan did not turn on his team at the end of the match, because that just would have been far too predictable. Plus, I think he works better as a face. But basically, it came down to 2-on-1. Justin Gabriel and Wade Barrett against John Cena. Now, John Cena was already laying on the outside. When Daniel Bryan got eliminated, Cena was on the outside. He was already in a bad way. So basically, Nexus beats him around for a while. This actually felt like it went on forever. They go on the outside, and both Wade Barrett and Justin Gabriel begin picking the mats up off the floor. They're exposing the concrete floor. So Wade Barrett goes to give John Cena a DDT on the exposed concrete, and he hits it. He DDTs him on the floor. You would think, well, that's the end of John Cena. Oh no. Oh no. He rolls John Cena into the ring and proceeds to instruct Gabriel to climb to the top rope for his 450 splash. He's going to splatter John Cena all over the ring. And Gabriel goes up, and I called it. I mean, before he even started climbing the ropes, I knew exactly where this was going. I was hoping I was wrong. I was not. He goes for the 450. Cena rolls out of the way and proceeds to then pin Gabriel. And then John Cena goes ahead and gives Wade Barrett the STF. He puts him in the STF submission. Barrett doesn't tap right away, but within 10 seconds he does. Wade Barrett taps out to John Cena in the STF. Cena shows no ill effects whatsoever from this DDT on the concrete. And that right there is what infuriated me. John Cena, as great as he is, as much merchandise as he sells, he is the worst seller I have ever seen. In terms of a main eventer, a big star, somebody who's been in the business now for, you know, well over 8 years, 8 or 9 years, 10 years, whatever it's been, he cannot fucking sell a move. He is terrible. Go watch Sabu at the Hardcore Justice TNA pay-per-view last weekend. when he got the 5-star frog splash from RVD, he was selling those ribs like his entire rib cage had collapsed, even after the match. That is how you sell a move. Why is Sabu in 2010 a better seller than John Cena? The man cannot sell a move. You were just DDT'd on concrete. It's bad enough that Super Cena returned and you won the match. But you know what? Fine. But he was none the worse for wear. He was smiling. He was posing. You would not think the guy had a scratch on him. You would not think the guy had just gone through a 35-minute war, had gotten his ass handed to him. I mean, you won the match. The least you could do was sell the beating. No, couldn't even do that. So I don't blame Cena for you know, the whole thing about, well, Cena won. Well, that's not Cena's fault. It's not like Cena is lobbying to win the match. It's the booker. It's Vince McMahon, who fucked up by having Nexus lose in the manner in which they did. I don't blame Cena for that. But I do blame Cena for doing a piss-poor job of selling the beatdown. And whoever idea it was to have that DDT spot on the concrete ought to be ashamed of themselves. That spot had no business being in that match. You know, we don't see that very often. We used to see that back in the day. People would lift up the padding on the floor and expose the concrete for a maneuver. You know, it's been a while since we've seen that used in the middle of a match. I mean, I do remember Kurt Angle and Steve Austin during their feud in the summer of 01. I remember an episode of SmackDown where Austin exposed the concrete and actually gave Angle a pile driver. You know, with Kurt and his bad neck on the concrete, and that was made out to be a huge deal. You expose the concrete, you give the guy a DDT, you drive his head into the ground. Unless that's going to play into the finish or some sort of injury storyline, you should not use that in the middle of a match. I'm sorry. It makes absolutely no sense. It pissed me off so much. It probably pissed me off more than it should have. But the fact that they did that, and it didn't play into any sort of injury storyline, and it didn't even play into the finish of the match, which came within 3 minutes of that. Just unbelievable. Oh, my God. What a fucking terrible spot. So the end of this match just pissed me off immensely. And the question is, where do you go from here? Obviously, they've got to keep this storyline going, right? I mean, they have to. I mean, I guess they don't have to, but you would hope that they have enough common sense to keep it going. Have Nexus come out perhaps on Raw tonight and just lay waste to everybody and try to get back some of that. I don't even know. I worry that losing the way they did hopefully did not do as much harm as I think it did. But then again, you know what? If this pay-per-view pops a buy rate of, let's say, 350 to 400,000, you still have far fewer people watching this pay-per-view than a typical episode of Monday Night Raw. You know, it may not really mean much in the end, but I guess we'll see. We'll see where they go with it. Not the way I would have booked it, but hey, what do I know? God, that finish just pissed me off. I'll give SummerSlam a 6 out of 10. No higher than that. So, let's get into some other news here, because there was a lot of it this past week, and I want to get to at least the key stories here, one of which is a very sad one. As pretty much all of you, I'm sure, by now are aware, the news came out on Friday that former WWE star Lance McNaught, better known as Lance Cade, was found dead, I believe it was at his parents' house, his father's home, on Friday morning. The belief is that he passed away actually late on Thursday, but the news didn't come out until Friday. Passed away from what was believed to have been heart failure. And Cade was only 29 years old. Now, I thought he was a little older, but apparently he was only 29, which, what a waste of life, you know, to go at the age of 29. Now, it was no secret that he had had issues before. I believe it was abuse of prescription painkillers, and that really is what led to his initial departure a couple of years back from WWE. And basically, just to give a recap of what happened, and this was originally reported by the Wrestling Observer, but Cade's wife had noticed over the past week or so that he didn't really look very good. He wasn't looking very healthy. He was having some difficulty breathing, and he was rushed to the hospital on Tuesday night. This was last week. And on Wednesday, Lance just could not wait to get out. He asked to be released. He left the hospital, and went home, left, and did not return home. He was very angry. He was in a very emotional state. He left. His wife didn't know where he was. I guess on Thursday, his father had called his wife and said that Lance had showed up at his workplace and was not looking very good. So Lance, I guess, went home with his father and was later discovered in bed as having passed away. Just a sad story, basically. I mean, when he was a student of Shawn Michaels. In fact, I think he was one of the first students of Shawn Michaels as part of his Texas Wrestling Academy back in 2000, 2001. That was during Shawn's time off from the business during his initial, you know, quote, retirement. He might have been part of the same class, actually, with Brian Danielson and Spanky, better known as Brian Kendrick. As a matter of fact, I know that Cade was actually tag team partners with Brian Danielson in Japan very early on. This would have been back when Cade was probably only like 18 or 19 years old. You can probably find videos on YouTube of them competing in Japan as a team. So I know the two of them knew each other. But Cade idolized Shawn Michaels. I mean, he grew up emulating him and wanting to be like him. In fact, at one point, he was in the company initially as Garrison Cade. This was back when Lance Storm was still working for the WWE. And, you know, God knows we can't have more than one Lance in the company because people will get confused. So they renamed him Garrison. And at one point, there was a belief that he was going to be repackaged with a gimmick where he would call himself HB Cade. And it would be kind of a takeoff and on Shawn Michaels, and he would feud with HBK. And, of course, that didn't happen. He did come back to the company many years later, and that was when he was paired off with Trevor Murdoch. And they had the Murdoch and Cade tag team. They did win the World Tag Team titles on the Raw brand at one point, and then they dropped them. It was during actually that period when he was teaming with Murdoch. I recall there being an incident at a house show with them in Crime Time. There was some sort of issue. And that actually resulted in Crime Time being fired from the company before they were eventually brought back. So there was that. I mean, Cade really didn't get featured until it was around 2008. He was Chris Jericho's lackey. And he actually got a victory, as I recall, in a tag team match once on Raw over Shawn Michaels, which was one of the biggest wins of his career. And there were teases that maybe he would be in a feud with Michaels. I mean, the whole point of them breaking up the Murdoch and Cade tag team was because they had big plans for Lance Cade. And obviously those plans never really came to fruition. Now what happened was, during that last big run when he was Jericho's lackey, the reason he got fired was there was an incident on an airplane. This would have been in the fall, like around October of 08. And on that flight, he had a seizure, which was believed to have been due to the use of painkillers or perhaps muscle relaxers. And I think the entire flight had to be diverted to save the guy's life. And he was taken off the plane, and he was released, I think, almost immediately after that. Supposedly, he had addressed those issues. I guess he had gone to rehab and whatnot. The following year, there was actually a storyline that WWE had conceived of, specifically for him. And they actually re-signed him, I believe it was in September of 09, so this was last year. They had re-signed him, and they didn't really do anything with him. I mean, many months he was pretty much waiting at home, waiting to start. And as the story goes, he was on the phone with a WWE official. Who this official was, I don't know. There was a phone call between them in January of this year, and I guess the WWE official was a little startled by what he heard on the other end of the line. I guess Cade didn't sound good, he wasn't very coherent, he was slurring his speech. Clearly there was some sort of an issue. And Cade recognized this, and he actually asked WWE to send him to rehab. And he completed, I believe it was a 30-day rehab program that he finished off sometime in February. And supposedly he was a model citizen in rehab. He did everything he was supposed to do. He was improving. He did very well. And unfortunately for him, after he finished the program, whatever storyline idea that they had come up with for him had either been given to somebody else or they decided they weren't going to go in a different direction. The idea got scrapped, and he was released from his contract again in April. And he was very upset. He was very bitter about that, as anybody probably would be. But then, supposedly he got past it, and he accepted it for what it was, and I think more recently he's been wrestling in Japan. As a matter of fact, I believe he was supposed to wrestle on a show for, I think, All Japan Pro Wrestling at the end of this month, teaming with Rene Dupree, who was also a former WWE star. I believe they were going to be wrestling for the tag team titles. And he had been competing in Japan now the last couple of months and actually was booked pretty strongly. I don't think he did very many, if any, jobs in Japan. You know, he was a bigger, thicker guy. They liked that sort of thing. And, that would have been on the 29th at Sumo Hall when he was supposed to team with Dupree. Just a sad state of affairs. I don't really know what else to say. Anytime anybody passes away, it's sad. When you hear of somebody passing away at 29 years old, it's just such a waste of life. It just should not happen. What's eerie for me about this, what's really eerie, in fact, is within the last year, I don't remember exactly when, but sometime within the last 12 months, I listened to an interview that was conducted actually at the Pro Wrestling Insider website. Mike Johnson, I believe it was, conducted a phone interview with Lance Cade. And it was a lengthy interview. I want to say the interview went about 90 minutes or so. And they covered his entire career, coming up in the business, training with Shawn Michaels, his first run in WWE, his second run in WWE. This I can't remember if this was before or after he was signed the second time, but it was sometime around then when this interview was conducted. And he spoke openly about his problems and his demons and his addictions in this interview. And I'm paraphrasing here because I don't have the transcript in front of me, but at one point, and I'll never forget this, he said he was talking about, you know, wrestlers who do drugs and who fall into problems and who die at a young age. And he basically said he was scared to death that he would be one of those people. He did not want to be one of those people who dies at a young age like that. And that, you know, that's why he recognized he had an issue and he went to rehab and he did what he had to do. So I think back to that interview now and now the news of him, you know, dying at 29, and it's just, wow, you know, talk about prophetic words. And unfortunately, you know, I don't want to speculate because we don't know for sure what killed him, but my whole thought process on this goes a little something like this. If this guy licked his problems like the belief was that he had many, many months ago, and he was clean when he died, and there was nothing in his system, and he didn't overdose, he wasn't abusing drugs, I find it hard to believe that he would suddenly die at the age of 29, as opposed to, say, sometime in his 30s. It's almost like Eddie Guerrero. Eddie Guerrero had issues with painkillers and prescription medications, and he also drank. But Eddie had supposedly licked those problems. Now, all the stuff about Eddie being sober for 4 years when he died, as it turns out, that might not have been true. But still, the belief is that all the drugs and all the bullshit that Eddie was going through, that he had conquered those demons. And what happened to Eddie Guerrero? His heart gave out, 38 years old, and he died in a hotel room. If Lance Cade truly was not doing anything like that at the time of his death, I just find it hard to believe that at 29 his heart would suddenly stop. You know what I'm saying? I mean, does it mean that he was abusing drugs right up until the day he died? I don't know that, and I'm not going to speculate on that. I'm just saying something about this seems a little off to me. You know what? I hope he did successfully go through those rehab stints and was not doing anything like that, but I just find it hard to believe that he kept his nose totally clean, you know, these last couple of months, if just one day at the age of 29 his heart just goes. I just find that a little hard to believe, because normal people's hearts do not just go in their 20s. Very rarely will you hear about that. So in any event, it doesn't really matter. Either way, it's a sad story. Shawn Michaels, who is now Twittering, posted about it on Twitter. Obviously, he was devastated. He said the family actually contacted Shawn. As I understand it, that was one of the first things they said. They wanted to contact Shawn directly and let him know because, you know, the two of them, obviously, they had a bond. They were very close. He was one of Shawn's original boys, basically, that he helped train. And Shawn was pretty, as you might expect, pretty broken up about the whole thing, as a lot of people were. Carlito went on Twitter and did say something stupid. Literally, just within a few hours of the news breaking, he went on Twitter and basically said, you know, I think it was an overdose. That was kind of stupid. He got yelled at, obviously, by a whole bunch of people, because a few hours later he posted an apology for that. I mean, it's one thing to who knows? I mean, that may well be true. It's one thing to speculate on that in private, or in a different forum, but to just go on Twitter and just post a tweet saying, hey, I think the guy overdosed, when people at that time still didn't know what was going on. They didn't know for sure what the cause of death was or anything. And to be one of the boys, so to speak, to be a wrestler and to just go ahead and do that was probably not the wisest move in the world for him to do. But I know he felt bad about that. So just a sad story. And when we find out more about this, if we find out more about this, I'm sure I'll mention it here on the podcast. But right now, that's really all that we know. The other story that came to light a couple of days ago was the suspension of one of the WWE divas from the SmackDown brand, former ECW general manager, in fact, Tiffany, whose real name is Taryn Terrell, was suspended by World Wrestling Entertainment following an arrest, which was actually last Sunday, I believe, in L.A. Not yesterday, but a week ago. Apparently, this stemmed from a domestic disturbance, dispute, call it whatever you want, between her and her husband, Drew McIntyre, at a hotel that they were staying at. Now, that's really all that we know. From that, you can glean that if there was a, quote, domestic disturbance, and that if Tiffany only was arrested and Drew obviously was not in any way punished, she probably beat the shit out of Drew McIntyre, which is, I mean, look, I don't know what the nature of the dispute was. And look, kudos to Drew if that's what happened, because, you know, it's rarely, if ever, is it right to raise a hand to a woman. And, you know, Lord knows there's been plenty of wrestlers over the years that unfortunately have not subscribed to that same philosophy. I don't know what happened, but obviously she did something very badly, and she was arrested, she was suspended, and I think she's out on bond. But supposedly the suspension is indefinite, and it would not be surprising if it resulted in a termination. That is what I have read. So not a good situation for Tiffany. I guess not a good situation for Drew either, since it is his wife. And once we find out more about this, talk about it here on the podcast. So there you go. Scrap Iron. Adam Pearce has been fired as the head booker for Ring of Honor. This news was just posted in the last day or two. I'm not sure exactly if there was a specific incident. I don't believe there was. I just think it was a decision, from what I understand, that was made by ROH owner Kerry Silken, who is the owner and the financial backer of the Ring of Honor shows. I've met Kerry before. He's usually actually standing outside in the lobby when people are leaving the Ring of Honor shows in New York, just standing around, you know, wishing everybody a good night, shaking hands, taking pictures. It was his decision to fire Adam Pearce. Now, for those of you who are not aware of who Adam Pearce is, you really should do some YouTube and Google searching. He may not look like much on the surface, but he actually is a very good wrestler and very entertaining. He's very old school in the way that he conducts his, not just his matches, but his promos. He's a very good promo guy. He was a wrestler for Ring of Honor and took over the head booker position when Gabe Sapolsky, who was the head booker of Ring of Honor from the very beginning and actually an understudy of Paul Heyman in the original ECW, a couple of years ago when Sapolsky was relieved of his duties, Pearce took over. And he was kind of doing the wrestler-slash-booker thing. And then I really didn't hear about him wrestling in Ring of Honor much anymore, just because of the conflict of interest that it caused. But more so because it's just a lot of work booking for the company, and you really can only do one or the other. So he would still wrestle. He still wrestles for the NWA and on the independents. But in Ring of Honor, for the most part, Pearce was booking and working hand-in-hand with Jim Cornette. Jim Cornette is not booking Ring of Honor, but he has been working for them in a producer role for a while, helping out where he can. And from what I understand, Cornette is not going to be the new booker. It will be Delirious, who is a wrestler on the Ring of Honor roster, which, again, begs the question, is Delirious going to be wrestling as much? I would guess not, since he's going to be booking now. But Jim Cornette apparently will have a heavier influence. He'll be helping Delirious with the booking duties in ROH. So kind of a shame, really, if you think about it, because Pearce, from what I had just read, within the last couple of weeks, had been offered a tryout match by TNA, and he had turned them down. Now, I'm not sure if he turned them down because he just doesn't want to wrestle for TNA. My guess would be he probably turned it down because he's got a lot of work on his plate, being booker and wrestling on the independents, and he, you know, being the NWA champion. And if that is, in fact, what happened, to turn that opportunity down and then find out, hey, by the way, you're fired as the booker for Ring of Honor, that sucks. But he's a talented guy. It would be nice if he got a look by either TNA or even WWE. You know, he doesn't have a phenomenal body or anything like that. That might work against him in WWE, but as a promo and like as a character, he's very good. He really is. Like I said, in all honesty, he doesn't look like much, but when you listen to him and you watch him, he's very good. He's a very good worker. And I took this to mean that he's gone altogether from Ring of Honor. I suppose it's possible that he has been relieved as booker, but he'll still wrestle there. Although, if there's any bad blood, he might not want to. So my guess is that he's just completely gone from ROH and divorced from them now. And he'll wrestle for the NWA. He'll wrestle on the independents. And my hope would be that one of the bigger organizations gives him a second look. Because he deserves it. I became an Adam Pearce fan, by the way. I have not been to a live Ring of Honor event in a long time. Probably too long. But one of the Ring of Honor shows I was at, it was either last year or in 08. There was some sort of tag match. And Pearce was in there. And for months, in the other Ring of Honor shows in New York that I had been to, he was being bombarded by chants of Repo Man, because he does bear somewhat of a resemblance to the Repo Man. Except, you know, he doesn't have, I don't believe, maybe he has a faint goatee. I don't think he has any facial hair. But and it was more of a comedy thing, and he would pretend like he was really annoyed by it, and people would just chant Repo Man even louder at him. And then at one of the shows I went to, he was part of a tag match, and in the middle of the match, all of a sudden, and he might have been waiting for the fans to chant Repo Man, all of a sudden he reaches into his tights, and he pulls out the old Zorro Repo Man eye mask. And the place went just fucking ape shit. I could not contain myself. It was the most awesome moment at that entire show. It made the night for me, and from that day forward, I became an Adam Pearce fan. He never did the gimmick again that I saw, but unfortunately, it was just the one night that he must have just cut it out himself from some other piece of clothing, and he strapped it around, and goddammit, for those two or three minutes, he was wearing the Repo Man mask, and it was phenomenal. It was just awesome. He was doing the old Repo Man, if you go back and watch, he was a horrible gimmick, for those of you who don't know, from the early 90s WWF. I mean, I loved it, but really, it was just a terrible gimmick that Barry Darso, who used to play Smash of Demolition, and he was also Crusher Khrushchev in the old NWA, he was doing this gimmick where he repossessed things, and his motto was, you know, what's yours, his motto was, what's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine too, and then he would have this cackle, and it was a gimmick to nowhere, but it was entertaining for what it was. And so anyway, that was the genesis of that. But from that day forward, I became an Adam Pearce fan. I was thoroughly entertained by him. And unfortunately, he will not be booking Ring of Honor anymore. I guess they want to go in a different direction, I suppose. You know, the quality of the matches in Ring of Honor has not changed. If anything, his philosophy was working. You know, part of his philosophy when he was brought in as the booker was to tone down some of the early matches on the card that were burning out the fans. Because in Ring of Honor, everybody goes out there and they want to have the best match on the show. So you would have the opening match, the first two, three matches on a show, let's say, that was going to go 4 hours. And these guys would be doing moves and spots like you would think it was the main event. And by intermission, people would be burned out already. And you couldn't do that anymore. So part of his whole old school mentality and philosophy that he brought to the table was, you got to tone it down. You got to make the matches a little shorter. You can't go out there and blow everybody away with these big moves. You have to save it for the second half. You have to save it for the main events. And I think that has helped improve the ROH product. But there's always room for improvement. So, you know, we'll see. Delirious is one of their performers. He's kind of entertaining. He basically has this gimmick. He's a crazy guy. He wears a mask with tassels hanging from it. And he speaks gibberish. He does not speak English. He speaks gibberish. I hope he speaks English backstage while he's booking these shows. He also is head of the Ring of Honor school that they have, where they train people. So he does that as well. So now he'll just be adding these booking duties to his plate, I guess, going forward. All right, so let's talk a little bit of TNA here. I did not see the Hardcore Justice pay-per-view last weekend. I'm sure most people did not. Although, I'm almost positive the pay-per-view buy rate when we eventually find out what it was for this pay-per-view. And they don't release numbers, but you can still find out what the numbers are. Again, their last two or three pay-per-views have literally done in the range of 6,000 to 8,000 buys, which is just beyond atrocious. I'm almost positive this pay-per-view has to do better. I mean, maybe even as many as 20 or 30,000 buys. But I guess we'll find out. But nonetheless, it was the ECW One Night Stand Part 3 for all intents and purposes. I read reviews of the shows. It was a mixed bag, leaning more so towards negative than positive, which is not really all that surprising. It was what it was. A lot of the EV2 guys, as they're calling them, since they can't use the ECW initials, they call them EV2, were at the tapings that week after the pay-per-view. And, of course, they taped the big whole effing show special. And basically what it was, Impact last Thursday was a pay-per-view caliber edition of Impact. The original card that they had originally planned for the Hard Justice pay-per-view before it became an ECW reunion show, they basically took that card and put it on free television. And you knew it wasn't going to be as good because you've got to fit all those matches that were supposed to be part of a 3-hour pay-per-view into a 2-hour show with commercials. So a lot of the stuff felt rushed. I did check out Impact last Thursday, and my impression of it is this. It was a pretty good show, but there was a lot of crap on it. They were promoting this show as a show that had all wrestling and no talk, which was a fucking lie, number one. But a lot of the action on the show was good. I mean, Jeff Hardy and Shannon Moore, for example, had a good match. Shannon Moore as the mystery opponent for Jeff Hardy, epic fail. The match itself wasn't bad. Obviously, the big match on this show was the final match in the Best of Five series between the Motor City Machine Guns and Beer Money. Best 2 out of 3 falls for the TNA Tag Team Championship. Just a phenomenal match. I mean, what more can really be said? I can say good things about this match all day long. It was every bit as good, I think, as everybody expected it to be. And the only bad part about it is that it's all over. you know, the series between the two teams is over. And for a couple of weeks there, we got some great wrestling. It culminated in probably the best match of the entire series between these two teams. And it really illustrated how weak the tag team division is in WWE. Even though, and these aren't the only two teams TNA has, but even if they were, they're so damn good, it just, everything else pales in comparison. So, 2 thumbs up on this match. It was a phenomenal effort. The Machine Guns win, and good stuff. Very good stuff. You know, other matches on the show, Anderson, Matt Morgan, and the Pope, not so much. Kurt Angle and AJ Styles actually had a very good match to open the show, but it was only about 7 or 8 minutes. And why you would shortchange that match of all the matches on the show, I don't know. I would have, I mean, give those guys 12 to 15 minutes to kick off the show and really get things off on the right foot. It was a good match, don't get me wrong, but it could have been so much better. RVD and Abyss, I'm just going to skip to the main event here. It was basically, you know, Janus is what Abyss calls his bat with nails in it. And it was Janus on a pole or whatever. It was hanging and I don't know. I mean, the match itself was, it was good for what it was, but you know what? You got to be fair about this. I spent some time earlier in this podcast bitching about the fact that John Cena got DDT'd on concrete, and then 2 minutes later, he was fine. In this match, we saw Abyss basically get powerbombed onto a shitload of thumbtacks. And within a few minutes, if I remember correctly, he wasn't selling it. It was almost as though it had never happened. And again, why do stuff like that? I don't understand why you would put your body through that and why you would be booked with garbage spots that involve nails and thumbtacks and broken shards of glass and all the bullshit if it doesn't mean anything 3 minutes later. I don't understand what goes through these people's heads that makes them think, hey, you know what, that's a good idea. Why don't I blow my brains out this morning? That sounds like a good idea. Why not? Oh, hey, look, there's a broken piece of glass on the floor over there. Let me go step on it. Great idea. So that kind of pissed me off. RVD wins. He retains the TNA championship. Hulk Hogan comes out. And the big surprise that Hulk Hogan was hyping was the fact that he had brought a lot of RVD's extreme brothers back to the Impact Zone one more time to celebrate with him. So most of the ECW guys come back out. Dreamer, Rhino, you know, just the Dudleys, a whole bunch of people come out. Eventually Raven came out and Sandman came out, but that came later on. And they're all celebrating in the ring, and the lights go out. And the belief is that, it's the Sandman. Here comes the Sandman. And the lights come back on, and it's not the Sandman. It's a bunch of TNA guys. It's Ric Flair's, members of Ric Flair's Fortune Group. You've got Beer Money. You've got AJ Styles. You've got Kazarian. Ric Flair eventually made his way out. Just a whole bunch of guys out there. Doug Williams. And they begin to lay waste to the ECW guys. Now, again, I read the spoilers in advance for that show, and I read, oh my god, this was a phenomenal beatdown segment. You've got to see this. Well, I had already read that weeks and weeks ago when TNA did the first big angle where the ECW guys invaded, and they said, oh, it's the greatest segment ever. It's even better than the initial Nexus invasion. And I said, wow, I've got to see this. The Nexus invasion was pretty damn good back in June, so this has got to be better. And I remember watching that first one on Impact many weeks ago and thinking, this was the most pathetic, quote, invasion angle or beatdown that I have ever seen. It was tame by comparison to what they did with Nexus. So when I heard people raving and ranting about this one, I was skeptical, to say the least. And this one was actually a little bit better than the first TNA invasion, but it was still nothing much. It didn't, you know, again, when people hype it, oh my god, this is the best thing ever, you gotta watch this, more often than not, you're gonna watch it and be disappointed. There was nothing overly special about it. It was a beatdown angle. People were getting the shit kicked out of them. People were bleeding. Whoop-de-fucking-do. Ric Flair comes out. He gets in Dixie Carter's face. It's all your fault. It's all your fault. I have seen so much of Dixie Carter, I don't need to ever see her again. I mean, it's troublesome to me that we keep seeing shots of her. I mean, they would always pan back to her during this whole thing, and they would show Dixie in the crowd standing there with Terry Taylor and all this concerned look on her face. The expression, by the way, on her face never fucking changed. You know, the show closing angle was strong for what it was. It was not the best thing I've ever seen, nor does it have to be. It was effective, okay? It was effective. The one thing I didn't like is looking at RVD covered in maple syrup on the floor backstage. Right, maybe it wasn't maple syrup, but it looked completely hokey. Rob Van Dam is literally laying in a pool of blood, and they show Abyss standing over him with the bed of nails, with the board of nails, the bat, whatever the fuck it is, screaming and ranting like a madman. So we are left with the impression that Abyss has murdered Rob Van Dam, in fact. It was like something out of a Saw movie or Friday the 13th. I mean, there was so much blood on the floor. It was, you couldn't help but laugh. And I don't think that was the reaction they were going for, unfortunately. But I, you know, there's a difference between just enough, you know, less is more, and going a little overboard. I would say they went a little overboard with the blood. Just completely hokey. I could not take that seriously at all. It was ridiculous. So then I stayed tuned, and I watched the first episode of TNA Reaction, which is their new reality-esque show where they follow the lives of the TNA superstars, and it's also part recap show. They recapped and showed replays of a lot of the angles from Impact that we just saw. I will say this. There were parts of the show that made me cringe. The Abyss stuff I was not a fan of. It's just too hokey for me, but I actually really like this show overall. I love the concept of it. I really, you know, for years I've said WWE really should do something like this, and in fact, when the NXT concept was first announced, on this podcast, I talked openly about how excited I was. I thought it would be more reality-esque than it turned out to be. I thought they were going to follow the stars of NXT, kind of like a day in the life of, and show them on the road, or show them training, show them at home. We would get some insight into who they really are. Of course, they took NXT in a completely different direction. NXT is a fucking piss-poor excuse for a wrestling show. It definitely did not live up to its potential, but there is potential here for this reaction show. I would even say I'll probably watch episode number 2, because it can only get better. Again, I'm willing to give them a pass on the parts that I didn't like because it was just their first one. I really like the concept of this show. Dixie Carter is a fucking atrocious actress. I mean, she is just horrendous as an actress. She should never act again. She should never even be on my TV screen again. But, you know, they showed AJ Styles and Kazarian backstage talking to each other about, you know, the attack. And they had a segment where the knockouts, Angelina Love, Velvet Sky, were talking trash about one another. And Velvet Sky was calling her a bitch. And she was saying how that bitch got what she deserved. And very, very un-PG, which is nice. It's a nice, refreshing change of pace from the PG WWE. But I'll give Reaction a thumbs up. Not a perfect show. There was a lot of hokey crap on there that I could do without. At the end of the day, you can't do an exact carbon copy of the UFC, you know, countdown specials, for example, that style of show, because at the end of the day, UFC is real and wrestling is fake. I mean, that's the big difference there. But you can still do a show that borrows a lot of the aspects from what UFC, for example, is doing. And I keep saying UFC because what UFC is doing is working. So, you know, and God knows the wrestling business has for years been known for blatantly stealing and copying ideas. If you're going to steal an idea or copy an idea, at least steal or copy one that works. I like the concept. There's room for improvement. I'll probably check it out in the future. I think you should too. You know, the more you support shows like that, it actually did very well in the ratings, all things considered. For the half hour that it aired after Impact went off the air, reaction did, I believe a 0.9, which is actually not that less than what a typical episode of Impact would do. Actually, the big pay-per-view caliber edition of Impact this past week actually went down slightly in the ratings. So, you know, I don't know if that had more to do with their lack of promotion for the show or what, but that certainly was not a good sign. Now, a little bit of a TNA rant here, if I may. And there's going to be a spoiler here for the Impact coming up this week. So if you are an Impact fan and you do not want to be spoiled by what happens on Impact this week and what happens going forward with the championship, skip ahead. That's your warning. Now, obviously, RVD was left laying on Impact this past week, and it didn't look good. In fact, it looked like all of the blood had been drained from his body. And so, apparently on Impact this upcoming week, based on the spoilers that I've read, Eric Bischoff comes out and basically announces that RVD was hospitalized with head trauma, spinal trauma. He required 115 stitches. And possibly suffered punctured organs. Talk about overkill. 115 stitches, you say? I see. And Bischoff says that he met with Van Damme's doctors and Dixie Carter, and they've decided to vacate the TNA World Heavyweight Championship. Yep, that's right. The TNA title is now officially vacant. And it will be held up in a tournament. The top eight contenders, they kick off the tournament on Impact this week, and the finals will be held at the Bound for Glory pay-per-view. So, the reason that I am ranting about this is because Kurt Angle, for weeks and weeks now, has been running through the top 10 en route to the number one contender for the TNA Championship. He said he was going to start from the bottom and work his way up, and in fact, that is what he has been doing now for the last several weeks. Now, all of a sudden, the title is vacant. There is no champion. And so Kurt Angle is being thrust into a tournament just like any other guy. So unless I'm reading the spoilers incorrectly, and it is possible that maybe I'm misunderstanding here. And if I am, I apologize. But if I am understanding this correctly, essentially what it means is that all of Kurt Angle's hard work in working his way through the rankings thus far means absolutely dick. It means nothing. They started that angle, and they completely fucked it up. Way to go, TNA. I mean, what was the point? What was the point of Angle meticulously going through everybody one by one if you were just going to vacate the belt and just shove Angle in a tournament with everybody else? I mean, if Kurt Angle's in this tournament, and let's just say, hypothetically speaking, he loses, which he doesn't, but he loses in the first round, and that's it. His road to the title has been derailed through no fault of his own. It's just mind-boggling to me. You spend that much time on an angle. I mean, if RVD came to you and said, look, guys, I need some time off, or I think part of it may be he's contracted for a certain number of dates, and I think they were burning through too many dates, so they actually can't have him wrestle too much, or they violate the contract. So whatever the reason is, RVD says, okay, I'm going to be off for a while. You don't have to vacate the title. You can just have him drop. Why not have him just drop it to Abyss on Impact this past week? Have him drop it to AJ. Have him drop it to somebody else. You don't have to vacate the fucking belt. And I mean, if you want to do a tournament, fine, but you're completely fucking up this other angle that you've been working on. So, I just think that's incredibly dumb. Alright, so, I had a couple of other news bits I wanted to get to, but we're kind of running short on time here, so I'm gonna skip over that stuff. You all know that Linda McMahon won her primary in Connecticut. which was pretty much a given. She's going to be running for the Senate against Richard Blumenthal and the Democrats in November. I don't think she's going to win, but I don't think she doesn't have a shot. For everybody saying, oh, she's got no chance, I believe she definitely has a chance, but I just don't think she's actually going to win. And for those of you thinking that, well, if Linda loses, this is great, because as soon as she loses, they'll stop the PG crap and they'll lift the blood ban, keep dreaming. It's not going to happen. So if that's why you're hoping Linda loses the election, you're going to be sadly mistaken. That is not going to happen, at least not right away. So you can forget that. But let me skip over to the Expendables here. And again, a little bit of a spoiler review. If you have not seen the Expendables yet, and you plan on doing so, you might, again, just skip a little ahead here to the end of the podcast, because there may be some spoilers dropped here. So that's your warning. Now, I saw the Expendables on Friday night, and I could not wait. I could not wait even a day to go see this movie. I had to go opening night. This movie originally was due out in April, by the way. Got pushed back, so I had to wait even longer to see it. This was an all-star ensemble cast of action talent. You had Sylvester Stallone, who wrote, directed, and starred in this movie. You had cameos by Bruce Willis and Arnold Schwarzenegger, including one fantastic scene in a church where all three of them are on camera for about a minute, but it was still awesome. It's probably the best scene of the whole movie. You had Jet Li, Jason Statham, Dolph Lundgren, Terry Crews, Steve Austin, Randy Couture, Mickey Rourke, Eric Roberts. I may even be missing somebody. So you had an all-star cast of action talent. And it was kind of a, you know, an homage or an homage, if you will, to the old-school 80s action films that people like Stallone and Willis and Schwarzenegger and Rourke and all that were a part of. I was very happy with the movie. I was entertained. It did not, you know, blow my socks off or anything like that. I didn't come away thinking it was the best movie I've ever seen, but I did come away entertained thinking, man, that was a pretty damn good action movie. If you're looking for action, if you're looking for people to literally be blown in half, if you're looking for blood and guts, this is the movie for you. You're going to love it. There's also obviously a mix of comedy and lighthearted humor in there. I'm not going to bother, like, giving away plots or anything like that. I will say, you know, Eric Roberts is the main bad guy. Steve Austin is basically his henchman in the movie. And he gets, you know, a fair amount of screen time, not a lot of speaking time, but Austin's in there. Two things about Austin. The first thing is, there's one scene in the movie where basically Eric Roberts is the bad guy. He used to work for the FBI, either the FBI or the CIA, one or the other. And he's in this country. Oh, God, I forgot the name of the country. But in any event, he is basically profiting off the I guess it would be the drug trade down there, and working with the evil general that kind of runs the army down there. And the general's daughter is being a bit of a pain in the ass to them, and he wants her dead. So they find the daughter. They capture her. And in this one scene, Eric Roberts confronts the daughter and basically says, you know, look, I was raised not to hit a woman, but he wasn't. And he points to Steve Austin. And I thought to myself, uh-oh. And sure enough, a few seconds later, Austin goes over and punches her. Just punches her right in the face. Now, I know it's a movie and all, and maybe it's just me. And I'm not one of these people that gets my undies in a bunch. I'm not, like, politically correct or anything like that. But did you really need to put Steve Austin, of all people, in this particular scene where he has to punch a woman in the face, given the fact that Austin was once... Was he charged? I don't remember if he was charged. I don't remember exactly what ended up happening with that case. But basically, he once physically abused Deborah McMichael, his ex-wife. At least that was the belief. She had bruising. I don't remember if she was choked or if she said she was punched in the face. So when I saw Steve Austin punching a woman in the face here, I thought, eh, that might be in bad taste. But whatever, I got over it pretty quickly. And what I also thought was kind of funny was, and that wasn't funny, but what I thought was funny was later on in the movie, when Austin is actually in a fight scene with Randy Couture. So this was interesting here, because you have one of the biggest wrestling stars of all time in there with one of the biggest UFC champions of all time in Randy Couture. And they had a pretty intense fight scene. It was actually pretty badass. And unfortunately, basically Austin burned alive in this movie. KOTOR threw him into some flames, and Austin basically burned to death. So UFC wins out in this war over WWE. I'm sure Vince McMahon will not be happy about that. But anyway, if you're looking for a dumb action flick, if you're looking to have fun, if you're looking to check your brain at the door, this is the movie to do it at. Go see it in theaters, because this is the sort of movie where if you go see it with a whole big crowd of people, they're going to cheer, they're going to clap, you may get a standing ovation at certain points. It's really actually a lot more fun, I think, to see it in a big group of people like that. I still remember when I saw the Freddy vs. Jason movie when they did that a couple of years ago. Jason Voorhees and Freddy Krueger, and there was one part of the movie, there were actually several parts of the movies where people were cheering like crazy, but when the movie ended, if you remember in that movie, the very last scene, Jason is coming out of the water, and in his hand, he has Freddy Krueger's severed head, and then Freddy proceeds to open up his eyes and wink. And I vividly remember when that happened, and the movie goes to credits at that point, people were going apeshit. I mean, there were people giving it a standing ovation. It was incredible. So it's a lot more fun to see a movie like this, I think, in a big crowd of people. So yeah, go see it. It's worth the money. It's better than whatever crap is out there, you know, whatever crappy Julia Roberts is in the movies this week. It's worth it. Two thumbs up. On a scale of 1 to 10, I would probably give it a solid 7, maybe 7.5. So, definitely worth it. Not going to be able to get the feedback this week, but if you have any questions, comments, or anything to contribute, do email them to thesolomonster@gmail.com, thesolomonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/solomonster, and of course, friend me on Facebook at facebook.com/thesolomonster. Very simple. Want to give a quick plug here. My good buddy Pete, Amish Cousin Simon, will be in action. This is coming up next Saturday, this upcoming weekend, in fact, August 21st, bell time 7:30 p.m. at the world-famous Gleason's Gym in Brooklyn, New York at 77 Front Street. It is the World of Unpredictable Wrestling. August Ambush. It's coming up this Saturday, August 21st. Come out, show your love, show your support, and it's a good time, believe me. I've been to a couple of shows. It's always a good time. I'd be there if I could be. Unfortunately, this time I cannot be. Tickets are only $15, $10 if you're a kid. You can try to sneak in as a kid, maybe get the $5 discount. Don't tell them I told you to do that. But definitely check that out. We'll be back episode 122 next weekend, and I'm going to leave you here with a nice little song. I actually was not even aware that this existed. You know, I used to watch South Park, and I just kind of got out of it. I haven't watched it really religiously in a couple of years now, but I was amazed when I came across this. I was amazed at how great it is. In fact, I think I might like this version of the song better than the original. We're going to leave you here this week, the end of episode 121, with, yes, Eric Cartman singing Lady Gaga's Poker Face here on Sound Off. Until next time, be well, stay safe, take it easy, guys, and enjoy the music. Na, 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 na. Na, 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 na. What? I mean, anybody, come on, throw me a bone here. Probably the single dumbest thing I've ever seen in my entire life.
God, I love this business.
On SE Scoops.